Speaking of which, did you think about a name at all?
I tried to think of one. See, it's really difficult because what we're doing is so broad.
Yeah.
That it's hard to encapsulate in like some witty thing.
Yeah. We came up with that list last time.
I have that here.
What was that?
They're all very long though. Except for Does It Matter?
I kind of like that, actually.
Yeah, Does It Matter is short and kind of to the point.
And it's kind of what we're doing, I guess, in a way.
Should I check to see if there's something already named Does It Matter?
Yes.
They're going to hear this live. We'll edit, this out. Does It Matter podcast? There's one called What Does It Matter? But I think Does It Matter is different enough.
Right? It's four letters in a space different.
All right, sold.
All right.
Forbes likes to ask, does your podcast matter?
No, but that's fine.
That's what we do. We, podcasts are the most frivolous of all mediums in that way. This is like, oh no, we're just gonna make these easily and put them out for free.
Yeah, there's like a grassroots element to it, which means that there's some gems in there, but you have to sort through a lot.
Yeah, hopefully we can be towards the bottom edge of that category.
Yeah, that seems like a reasonable goal. We're listenable. Alright, well, hi.
Yeah, hi folks. Welcome to Does It Matter?
Yep. I'm Alex, that's Ben.
Yeah, here we are with an episode I'm incredibly excited about.
Okay.
It's the epic episode.
It is.
So I wanna just jump right into it with my first example.
You're
which
clearly bursting, so
well, here's the weird thing that happened this week. The three things that I picked favor in like my top five favorites of each of those mediums.
Oh.
So I'm working with like all stuff I'm incredibly passionate about, and I'm excited to talk. So I'm going to start by talking about a television show which Alex told me I needed to watch, and I tried and I failed. I got 8 episodes into the first season and just kind of didn't have the energy for it anymore, because it's very labor-intensive, especially at the beginning.
That's a good word for it, or phrase, I suppose.
It's Wire. It's a show. Let's see, I have notes on this. Here we go. It's an HBO show. It ran from 2002 to 2008. It's 5 seasons somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Over the space of, five to 6 years.
Yeah.
It was created by an author who was also a police reporter. His name was David Simon, and he's kind of, like, purported to be, like, the huge creative force that made this whole thing work.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing like this has ever really been done before.
Yeah, certainly not on that scale.
And not with such a knack for institutional understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Like, To go all the way back to the beginning for people who've never heard of The Wire, it's a TV
also,
show.
Who are you? Come on.
Yeah, about the police force in Baltimore, as well as 5 different other communities, and those communities interact with one another in just the natural proceedings of their lives. You see into the court system. You see dock workers in Baltimore.
Yeah,
you see the police and city governments stacked out as far as like leadership goes and how they influence everything. You get to look at the educational system of Baltimore. You get to look at the Baltimore Sun newspaper offices. Like, you get this very broad, complete picture of this massive story that's being told about a whole squad, really, of police officers who just do major investigations on basically the drug trade.
All the aforementioned people.
Yeah. They're staking out somebody on each of those. So I have to say, one of the things that's a little bit disappointing about the second season is it doesn't tie in as much to the rest of the show. Like, it's kind of connected. But yeah, the other four seasons, by and large, deal with the very same storyline with a massive group of characters.
Yeah.
It's the drug scene in Baltimore and how people connect to it. Now, there's some really cool trivia about The Wire that I just, like, had to offer as a way of explaining the magnitude of this show, which I will try to, but I will likely fail. Johns Hopkins, Brown University, and Harvard have all offered classes just on The Wire.
I bet those are fascinating.
I want to take one of those classes. Yeah. I just got the book All the Pieces Matter. It's the oral history of The Wire by all the people involved. As you see all these different factions of characters sort of forming connections, it shows how the communities are in contact with, like, the members of a community are in contact with each other within, like, the smaller groups and the way that they connect outwards. So the scale of it becomes very quickly, in a way, human epic, because you're constantly being impressed with, like, the scale and the magnitude of one action that takes place in one community as it echoes through the others.
Yeah.
I looked up on Wikipedia. There are 198 characters from The Wire who have their own Wikipedia pages.
Jesus.
That's how many people you're kind of going to kind of have to know the identities of every time that they're on screen.
Yeah.
During the, like, about 70 episodes this show ever did.
Well, that sounds about right. You can't talk during it because so much is going on. It's...
Yeah, there's no scene thrown away.
Yeah.
And you get to see how choices made kind of realistically impact things. It's not... Up until the very last season, which gets a little bit, like, magical realism, yeah, in a strange way.
A little bit more sentimental.
It's definitely more sentimental and a little bit more whimsical. But until you get there, it's this just, like, hauntingly realistic portrayal of the way that, like, violence functions and the way that people hurt themselves and each other on, like, the smallest of scales. It's... So impressive to see, like, crime and the police and the drug trade all, like... The people who wrote it were people who had been on police forces. Like, they knew how this stuff actually was. So it doesn't run like another cop show. Especially, yeah, since there's an entire scene where two detectives solve a murder by saying the word fuck with different emphases.
For, like... 4 minutes.
Yeah, you can check this out on YouTube, and it's gonna sound like it's gonna bring up worse results than it does, but it's the fuck scene from The Wire.
Oh my god, yeah. And then, like, that comes really early in the show, if I remember correctly.
It does.
It's like episode 4, and it just it's a great example of the kind of humor the show has that's, like, just very dry and very dark.
Yeah, and oddly Shakespearean at all times.
Yeah. In that kind of vulgar kind of way.
Right.
Vulgar.
So yeah, when you first said it was going to be epic for the theme, my first reaction was just, oh no. Please, not that. I can't stand any movie that's over 2 hours long without getting, like, really cranky about the way it ends. What do I actually like that's epic? And then I finished watching The Wire, and I was just like, well, here we go.
That. Alright. Yeah, it's a good show. You should watch it if you haven't. Okay, so I'm going to do, like last time, I have kind of an order and a progression to this, and I'm going to start with the first thing that occurred to me when Epic came up as a topic, and that is Wheel of Time. So Wheel of Time is a series of fantasy novels written by Robert Jordan, which was the pen name of a dude named James Oliver Rigney, who was from Charleston, South Carolina. It was the first novel. Actually, let me see if I can remember all 14 here. We got Eye of the World, The Great Hunt, The Dragon Reborn, The Shadow Rising, Fires of Heaven, Lord of Chaos, Crown of Swords, Path of Daggers, Winter's Heart, Crossroads of Twilight, Knife of Dreams, The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light. Okay. So the first of those was published in 1990. The last was published in 2013. Robert Jordan died in 2007, but the series was completed. The last three books were completed by Brandon Sanderson, who also wrote like Mistborn and is a big name in fantasy right now, from Robert Jordan's notes and like partially completed chapters and things like that. And all of this was, like, overseen and approved by Robert Jordan's wife, whose name is Harriet, I think. I can't think of her last name right now, but she was also his editor. And they met back when he was, like, writing Conan novels and stuff back in the 80s. Okay, so in approaching this, one of the first things I did was kind of think about, like, what epic actually means. And the first thing that we think of, which is kind of hinted at in what you said about, like, not wanting to watch long movies and stuff,
right,
is scale. Length. And, this shit is fucking long. The shortest of those 14 books is, The Path of Daggers, which is 672 pages in the paperback edition, 226,687 words, and the audiobook is 23 hours and 31 minutes. I fell into a Wikipedia hole with this, by the way.
this topic invited that.
Yeah.
I explored a lot of The Wire's Wikipedia network.
The longest book depends on which of those metrics you're going by. The longest page-wise is Lord of Chaos at 987 pages. The longest word-wise is The Shadow Rising, 393,823 words. And the longest audio-wise is A Memory of Light, 41 hours and 55 minutes. The series in toto comprises 11,916 pages in paperback, 4,410,086, or 36 rather, words. Can't read my own damn writing. And the audiobooks are 19 days, 5 hours, and 25 minutes long.
Wow.
So, it's big. It's basically the story of... it's kind of a classical fantasy trope story in, like, teenager from a small town is the chosen one and saves the world. But as with the most of the best entries of the genre, it's, you know, it's about how it's done. And I'm gonna come back to that on my next one, actually. But what's important about that is that it kind of, like, applies to the classical definition of an epic, which comes from, like, the epic poetry, like Homer and Virgil and who wrote the Aeneid?
Virgil.
Was that Virgil? Okay. What's the other one? There's, like, a third guy.
I'm not sure.
Ovid. That's what I'm trying to think of. Anyway. High fantasy is, like, really inspired by that kind of epic poetry because it's about, like, you know, big words and deeds with high stakes and the history of nations and all of that. And, like, you really get that in this. You get, like, a couple of really interesting cultures. You get, like, these desert dwellers who have this, like, elaborate warrior culture. You get the weird people from across the sea who are, like, a mashup of, like, Asian, French, and Southern.
Okay.
And also enslave, like, magic users. You get a really interesting magic system that exploits the vagaries of the gender binary. in some fascinating ways. Kind of the central idea behind that is that magic is basically tapping into the true source, kind of like the Force style, but that source is divided in half into male and female halves, and the male half has been tainted by the Dark One, so like any men who can perform magic will go nuts and probably kill everybody. So like they play with that in a lot of really fascinating ways. But I think kind of the bullet point number three I have here under the heading Why Epic is the complexity of it. Like, not just the scope of it, but like all the interacting moving parts. And this is coming back to that points of view and things. There are 147 unique POV characters.
Wow.
For the sake of comparison, A Song of Ice and Fire has 24. The King Killer Chronicle has maybe 3, depending on what you count. there are 2,782 distinct named characters in the series. Just throwing that out there. But all of these characters have really different voices and kind of different fundamental ideas about the world, and there's a lot of miscommunication. Like, that's in a large part the basis of the series is miscommunication. But like, what that does is that you get all these different voices weaving together to give you all these different perspectives, and it's the note that I have. And I was trying to think of a better way to phrase it, and I can't. The note that I have is that it's a poetic of perspective rather than lyricism. Whereas, like, in more traditional, like, specifically poetry, it's... I'm trying to think how to say what I want to say, which I'm really bad at, so give me a second. It's about, like, maximalizing each word and like using kind of each word and phrase and moment as a gateway into what you're doing. And this does that really effectively with character. Like, you get a really interesting breadth of humanity in this. And so like, if it feels like it relates to the idea of epic poetry in that way. And sort of, not exactly a side effect, but a co-effect, I guess, is that, like, the idea of epicness evolves out of this, like, denotative literary form. Because if you look up epic in the dictionary, it's, like, you know, based on, like, ancient giant poetry and shit, or, like, sharing characteristics with that. So, like, there is a specific definition. But taking that poetic element of it into account, like, there is also an emotional reaction, and, like, that sort of becomes the feeling of epicness. And I'm gonna run with that on the next thing, but that's all I have for that one.
So I guess that leads to my second, which is one of my favorite video games of all time.
Mm.
It is... the third entry in the Elder Scrolls series. It's called Morrowind.
I want to play it so bad.
I have a copy of the disc. You should take that with you tonight.
What is
it? Can you install
it
on your computer?
Maybe.
I'm sorry. Like, that's how eager I am to get people to play this game. Like, I will give it to you today.
I can. It's PC, I assume.
Yeah.
Might be able to run it on the laptop. I could try.
It could work. Anyway, let's get to why Morrowind is such an epic game, and I would also hope to prove an enjoyable game. So I first met this game when I was, 13 years old, and I went insane for it. Because this is how the game starts, folks. You walk off of a... well, I mean, you wake up. You have a bad dream. Bad dream is, like, the only cutscene in the entire game. And it just, like, it happens to you, and you wake up, and the guy is standing there, and he's like, all right, what's your name? And so they get you off of the boat, and you're a prisoner, and they're giving you a new life. You just have to give them all of your information, and they'll walk you through into town, and now you're in exile on Morrowind. That's your punishment.
I do like that all the Elder Scrolls games begin with you as a prisoner.
It is a really fun touch. And they've used it in some interesting ways. Skyrim, not so much.
Yeah,
it was like the worst intro to a Skyrim game. To an Elder Scrolls game that I have encountered.
Like, I've only ever played that one in Oblivion, but like Skyrim's intro was a lot more simplistic than Oblivion's.
Well, and this is the beauty. Like, Skyrim starts you off with this very long intro to the fact that there's a civil war and the dragons are there. Like, it's boom, boom, all you're there to do is experience those two pieces of information and then start the tutorial.
Yeah, the, like, fantasy Donald Trump dragons.
Right. Then in Oblivion, it's, here's the king coming into your cell. We're going to walk you through a very elaborate dungeon. Mm. Oh no, there was an attack. He's going to, with his dying breath, send you onwards to fulfill his journey. Like, that was pretty epic. It was cool. I like it. Yeah. But it immediately set a tone for the game where you're like, I never played that main quest. I just wasn't interested.
Mm.
Like, I don't know. I hated the Oblivion gates opening. I think that was a major flaw in the game. It shouldn't have been included, because it's not fun.
It wasn't. It was kind of obnoxious,
actually. It's very tedious.
Especially as somebody who's trying to play stealth, which did not go well.
Right, yeah, you can't play stealth in there. The way that Morrowind starts off is so much simpler. It's, what's your name? And then you walk in, and you pick, like, your sign, you pick your class, you can make your own class. You just, like, you decide what your skills are, you decide what your, like, 8 different skill point, or, like, attribute points are. And then they set you free. That's basically, you walk through a house, you pick up an item, you're given instructions to go check in with this guy out in the hills, and that's it.
Hmm.
You just start walking into a completely unguided world, where there's no fast travel, there's no map markers, it's just you exploring a 9.4 square mile world. According to one thing that I saw online.
Huh.
According to the same source, Oblivion and Skyrim are bigger. But you'd never know it, because you don't walk over it. Also, there's,
not
like,
nearly as much.
Many, many years of changes in hardware in there.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I to me, having played all 3 games religiously, Morrowind feels the biggest. Because every time you need to make a run up to the Ashlanders, it's going to take you half an hour each way to get, like, back to the town where the quest giver is. You really are strategizing by picking up, like, every single quest as it happens, as you can possibly grab it. Like, just raid an entire town's quests.
So it becomes more about geography. It's like, what do I have to do here?
Exactly. And, I mean, like, your character never speaks. You don't choose dialogue, really. You just click on topics of conversation, and they pop up with text telling you what that person thinks about it.
Hmm.
Whatever information they have, you can click on quests and add them that way. Like, it's very straightforward and simple. But then the game becomes much more complex. It has 27 skills, where Skyrim only has 18. It's, like, there's 10 different weapons you can choose from, and they're all very unique. Like, it would be, like, you know, Skyrim reduces it to, like, one-handed and two-handed.
Mm-hmm.
One would be axe, one would be spear, one would be sword, one would be, like, short blade, okay. One would be, like, every weapon has its own thing.
Its own, like, skill tree and whatever.
Right.
Okay.
So it offers far more as that's concerned, and now I just want to talk a little bit about the main quest. Because main quests in Bethesda games, You're laughing just because I mentioned the phrase. Like, they're not traditionally
the point.
And they're never the most impressive line of quests in the game, even though they're usually the longest and the most, like, theatrical.
As a quick aside, just because it is my basis for comparison, what was your favorite quest in?
Oh, that's a tough question.
I know. We might have to come back to that.
You know, because of the way that it's presented, the one where you're walking through Solitude and the Argonian, I think his name is Jari-Ra, he's like, hey, you want to make some quick coin? And he sets you up with, like, what is obviously an evil plan, which he refuses to cop to. So then, like, the only option is either, like, don't complete the quest or go and do the slightly evil thing. And then they turn on you, and it's like, it actually has an element of surprise, the atmosphere of the presentation where he's, like, just leaning against the wall, and he's like, hey, I'm just saying, I got this plan for some coin, that's all I'm saying. Like, all quests are the same. You're going somewhere and you're killing something, and then you're looting a chest.
Pretty much, yeah.
So it's the little details like that that really set for me. Like, I love doing that quest.
Mine is similar. It's the, I don't remember which one it is, because I'm kind of bad at lore, but it's the Daedric quest where, like, he challenges you to a drinking contest, and then you wake up across the country and have to basically, like, hang over your way back, and it's like, ooh, I might have slept with a bog witch, and I stole a giant sheep.
Is it in Skyrim or with the Oblivion DLC? That sounds like
Skyrim.
The Elves of Sheograth.
Maybe it is Sheograth, but it is Skyrim. I know that for sure, because I don't think I played that far in Oblivion.
That was a really odd DLC, but that's not the point. So here's the cool thing about Morrowind. Its main quest is the most epic set of quests in the game.
Ooh.
But they're so difficult because they're not leveled to you.
Ah.
That you're actually told in between, like, say you do, like, three main tasks and come back to the main guy, Caius Cossades, for the majority of it. You hand him to him and he's like, cool, so I have more work for you. But first, you should really go out there, explore the world, and improve your skills, because this next one's going to be tough.
Hmm.
And they, like, make the recommendation based on what your level is. So he actually gives you good advice. It's an incredible way to operate the main quest. They leave you wanting more. You can't just rush through it and be done. You have to really stick with it the whole game. You're leveling up by, like, becoming a part of the Mages Guild and the Thieves Guild, the Fighters Guild.
I'm like, clutching my chest right now because, like, that is, like, the Achilles heel of open world games for me, is that there's not really that sense of pacing that really adds to the experience. Like, it gives you kind of a flow to fall into, which is really powerful.
Right, and the fun thing is, it's kind of a typical Bethesda plot. Like, so you start out, you deliver a package, then you have to interview six different people who are in three different cities, which gives you a good taste of, like, half of the map to start, or at least the important third of the map to start the game. Then you're told about this prophecy, so you have to go off to the Ashland, and the Ashland is this huge, long journey, and you're out in the middle of nowhere.
Up in the northern bit on the other side of the volcano?
Yeah, you're constantly getting attacked by these, like, powerful enemies, and it's just like, you don't want to be there. But then you get out there and you find this area, and, like, there's no more creature attacks, and you can just ask them about the prophecy. And then it turns out, like, there's these three different things that the prophecy has to fulfill, or things. And so you investigate each one individually, and you keep on getting these weird things where, like, you kind of fulfill the prophecy. But then they'll be like, but, I mean, it's kind of a weird coincidence that you would be, you know, finding it as you're experiencing it yourself. That's
sure.
That's pretty improbable. We'll find them eventually, but there's no need to go about trying to become this prophecy. And then by the time you've gotten, like, three out of the four of them, they're like, oh my. So there's actually a progression. There isn't that weird Bethesda thing where they're like, you're just an absolute jerk. Like, the guards walking down the street will accuse you of crimes you haven't committed. Just, don't do that. You're like, I thought
what
that
I
saved your village.
Right.
Or they do,
I'm
like, that
bane of this town, come on.
Yeah, they do that outright weird, like, worship thing, which is even more uncomfortable for me.
Yeah.
They don't do that in Morrowind. Everyone addresses you either as your name or your rank in the faction that you, like, are in.
Yeah, I want to play it. I want to play it so hard.
What makes these quests so epic is the lengths that you have to go to complete them, obviously. And I want to reiterate, there's no fast travel, which means literal hours. Like, the main part of the game is moving from place to place, which means you really are visually exploring things. You're looking for shortcuts. You're trying to figure out, like, exactly why the land is starting to change this way as it turns into the next, you know, section on the map. It's beautiful in that way, even though the graphics are now looking not quite as great as they were at the time.
Yeah, this was, like, when did it come out?
2002.
Okay.
I mean, that's 16-year-old graphics we're talking about.
I know.
They're still pretty good for 2002.
It's still weird for me to think that video games are that old.
Like real video games?
Yeah, like, I remember when they were a novelty still.
Mm-hmm.
That's odd.
The estimate of quests in Morrowind, depending on who online you believe, are between 300 and 500.
Wow.
Depending on how you count, but I can tell you right now, 300 quests means you're investing at least 400 to 500 hours.
Jesus Christ.
to do everything in Morrowind is a long investment.
Yeah.
I have done that once, but I haven't finished the game for sentimental reasons. I have a file save where the only thing I have to do left is fight Dagathyr, and I just can't do it. So I guess that's... I mean, here's the bottom line. It's epic in everything that it does. Like, the scale was unprecedented at the time. The detail on everything is still impressive for a Bethesda game.
I remember it was a big deal.
And when it comes down to it, this game is about you and your experience in the world, and not what Bethesda tried to show you with it, like, flashy... I mean, they're basically cutscenes. You can't leave the area and, like, you're just watching the cutscene and you're like, alright, yes, you wrote it and then you choreographed it and they're
now
voice
happening.
Acting and it's happening and I can't do anything but wait. They're great the first time, but this is a game that's meant to be replayed, and you can't skip that. Morrowind is just like, no, the power of the text is going to be the words themselves, because that's all that we have. And so they make the experience about you. It blows me away. It's just the most open game I've ever played. And I mean that as a colossal compliment.
Alright.
I told you, I'm very passionate about this week.
I know, I can see that. You're getting all fired up. I might get a little fired up about this one, because actually I also, for my second thing, chose a video game that I first encountered at about age 13. But it's funny to me, because I kind of went in a very different direction with it. Like, I went with something that is very linear and very choreographed and very, like, this is a story and you are part of it and, like, you are watching it happen also. Like, you get swept up in it. You don't necessarily completely control it, even though you are participating in it, which to me is an interesting balance. Like, I really like strongly narrative video games, and I know, like, a lot of people don't, because the freedom is an interesting thing, but I don't know. I'm talking about Final Fantasy VII.
I actually had guessed from the way that you were building.
Which, okay, was released 3 days before my 13th birthday on 9/7/97 by Squaresoft, which is now Square Enix. Like most of the Final Fantasy series, it was produced by Hironobu Sakaguchi. This one was directed by Yoshinori Kitase, which I believe he directed a couple of others as well. It is a game that is basically... Oh, how to sum it up? You start as a member of, like, an environmental terrorist group, basically, in a, like, the biggest giant dystopian city on this planet. And you are fighting against a corporation that kind of runs the city and therefore the world. But in the process of doing that, you stumble into this thing that's going on involving aliens and clones and false memories and weird coincidences and a giant meteor that's gonna blow things up and a slap fight on a cannon and all sort, like, one of the main characters is slight spoiler alert, a stuffed cat. No, a cat riding a stuffed boy that is being psychically controlled by a gangster.
Yeah, that.
You know.
That classic situation.
Right? We've all seen that before.
It's not even interesting anymore.
Another character is like a vampire. There's a guy who's like, he got his arm chopped off in an accident, so he put a machine gun there. Like, it's bizarre and crazy and huge and giant and, like, very easy to get swept up in that way. Which, like, is part of what made it so popular, I think. And also, like, why it has such an enduring reputation, to the extent that Square Enix is currently remaking it as, like, not just remastering, but, like, straight from the ground up, retelling this story in a new series of games, actually. I'm simultaneously really stoked for that and really worried about it. But we'll see. But beyond just, like, the nostalgia factor, like, this is a game that elicits a very powerful emotional response from a lot of people. In particular, the fact that there is, and again, slight spoiler alert, but the game is also 21 years old, so, you know, catch up. There's the fact that, like, for the first, it was released for the PlayStation, so it's, like, on multiple discs. So for the entire first disc, which is really, like, almost two-thirds, like, half to two-thirds of the game, it's, like, the lion's share of it. And then, like, disc two a bit shorter, and then disc three is basically just, like, the last bit, the final dungeon. But anyway, for the entire first disc, like, you're getting to know this one particular character. She's kind of, like, almost the main love interest. Like, in, like, it seems like they're going that way with it. And then at the end of the first disc, she is killed and you don't get her back. And that's a moment that, for, like, 13-year-old me and for a lot of other gamers at the time, like, came out of nowhere and was just, like, devastating and hugely resonant, and, like, it's, I can still see the entire scene in my head, and, yeah, like, I can, the music is there, like, it was a moment, like, I had to stop. And that kind of ties into where I'm going with this whole, like, progression of what epicness is and stuff. Because this game is not that long compared to Morrowind. I mean, I guess it depends on what your scale is, but, like, to do everything in it takes maybe 50 or 60 hours at most. Like, if you're just chugging through the main story, you could probably do it in less than 30. But it does kind of, like, meet that quality of the hero's journey and, like, you know, giant stakes and ultimate good and evil and all that kind of stuff. But it also is more participatory, like, because it is a video game, like, and I think this is one of the really cool potentials of this medium, like, reading that moment in a book would be devastating, but it's not quite as devastating when you feel like you've actually been interacting with that character, even if through a proxy. Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
Yeah.
So, like, moments like Eris's death, or the, like, final battle between Cloud and Sephiroth in the dark at the very end, or, like, taking down Emerald Weapon under the ocean after it's killed you, like, 5 friggin' billion times. That's, like, the secret boss that has, like, a jillion HP and takes forever to kill and is almost impossible to do without this one super magic spell that you can't get unless you breed racing birds.
Oh, yeah, I heard about that. It sounded reasonable.
Yeah. Like, I'm not saying it makes a whole lot of sense, but it's a really fun ride. And it feels really big, and it is capable of generating really big emotions, which is kind of where the epicness comes in for me.
One of my very closest friends in high school was, like, dedicated to Final Fantasy VII. he could not go more than, like, 14 seconds without doing an Sephiroth! Oh! I was like, yeah, all right, man. I get it. You really like that game.
Anyway. How many games do you know have Latin theme songs?
This is true. This is true. I guess it's something I'm going to have to play. I'll figure it out.
I think it's on Steam, maybe? I know there is a PC port of it. And I thought they put it up there, but I might be hallucinating that.
I've been meaning to find, like, a classic game that I haven't played, and this kind of fits the bill.
I would recommend that one.
I can finally get all those jokes he made. Oh, so silly.
Those are fun moments, like, when you go back to something, like, that somebody was all about, and you're like, oh, that's what you were talking about. Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. Who hasn't had that moment?
Yeah. Actually, that might be a fun theme for next week, like, things you experienced way too late.
You know, I got a lot to pick from, because I didn't really do anything until I was, like, 20.
Yeah, there's definitely a few choice ones I could go for there.
Okay, I guess I'll jump in. Okay, so I'm really torn with this last one, because I wrote down the example that for me truly fits the theme the most, but then there's also a band who emotionally resonates to me more with me mm-hmm. as far as an answer.
Okay.
But I don't want to spoil it. Like, I want to be able to use that one again later, you know? Because it's, like, my favorite band I would want to talk about.
I feel like I know who you're talking about.
I'm going to talk about my prime example, and then briefly as an honorable mention, which won't actually count as using the favorite band.
Fair enough.
Okay, so I want to talk about Aerion. Aerion is a progressive metal player, composer, performer,
auteur.
He's an auteur. He writes all of the parts for a lot of his songs and plays all the instruments himself. He won't sing, so he brings on a variety of guest stars. After his first couple projects, he got, like, so well-respected that he doesn't have to play a lot of instruments himself anymore, because he just has, like, people from Black Sabbath or... oh my gosh, I was reading a list of, like, the ridiculous people who've come on. Like, if they're a name in any type of metal, they've probably played with Aerion.
Okay.
The reason that I want to use him for Epic, one, his music is, it reaches to the farthest places that he can find in the galaxy and tries to inhabit those spaces musically. And he's really good at it. Truly, he is, but he's been
If every album released under the name Aerion is part of an interlocking sci-fi epic.
He Asimoved it.
And at the moment, there are 10 albums in the Aerion name.
Oh boy.
And I want to tell you a little bit about some of them, and especially about my favorite.
I'm very curious.
Great album names, in order.
Okay.
Aerion, colon, The Final Experiment. Then there was Into the Electric Castle, which was a double album.
That's a great name.
The Universal Migrator, also okay. A double album. The Human Equation. That one is more epic than it sounds, I assure you.
Okay.
Then of course, the classic 01011001, which is the ASCII code for the letter Y.
Okay.
Then, of course, there was Lost in the New Real, although that was under the name Anthony Arjun Lucassen, but it's his real name, but it still connects, so I'm including it. Then there's The Theory of Everything.
Okay.
And The Source. So, I want to talk about 2/3, depending on if you count a double album as 2. Hmm. The Human Equation is an incredible album. It's 20 tracks. Each of them represents a different day that a man is in a coma after he gets into a car accident.
Okay.
He goes back through his memory and recedes into his own mind and meets a whole lot of very interesting characters along the way.
I do love a crazy-ass concept album.
He only does crazy-ass concept albums. One of the days includes the revelation that his best friend and his wife have been cheating on him, although he doesn't know that because it happens in the hospital room outside. Gasp. I think my favorite is the bagpipe-laden song Loser. Maybe 10, I want to say. It's a story about him meeting his own dad inside of his mind, coming to terms with the fact that his dad was a piece of shit. It's more than I am describing it, I assure you.
I'm nodding thoughtfully and stroking my chin here.
It's like metal with bagpipes at the same time. For real.
That's another like soft spot. It's like I love it when bands use weird instruments.
Yeah. What I really want to talk to you guys about, though, I mean, you, Alex, and our listeners, because holy shit, The Universal Migrator is a double album. The first album is progressive rock. And then, I'm sorry, it's progressive metal. And then it's a little bit more, like, on the metal side of progressive metal for the second album.
Okay.
The first album is basically a guy is the last man on Earth. And he doesn't know where humanity went wrong, so he's going to get into a dream sequencer, which allows you to inhabit any space and time as long as you're in a dream state. And he just goes back and further and further and further in time, looking at all the different moments in humanity's history that he can think to search for an answer.
Hmm.
And there's songs made of a bunch of them. One of them is about the Aztec age and how magnificent their temples were.
Hmm.
The Temple of the Cat is the name of that song. Then there's him. The name of the song is fantastic. The Shooting Company of Captain Franz B. Koch. That's C-O-C-Q. That one is about the height of the British naval empire.
Okay. That makes slightly more sense then.
I think the last one before the album ends is he says that druids in the early centuries of the world did a magical ceremony which turned them into stone, and that's what formed Stonehenge. And then the second album starts with the dream sequencer saying, "You have, you've gone back too far. Like
system overload.
This is experimental now. We're not sure this is gonna work.
Okay.
Are you sure you want to go even further?" And he goes back to the Big Bang, and then he plays a solo on his guitar that sounds like what the Big Bang sounds like in his mind. And it's phenomenal. I don't even know how to get into the insanity of the way that he has instrumentalized the Big
Bang.
The song
on which that happens better be like 12 minutes long.
I think it's an 8-minute track.
Okay.
Yeah. Long enough for sun to get to the earth, right? Of course. I don't know if that was his reasoning, but I like to imagine it's something like it. Yeah, he then watches as time passes, the Earth forms, and he becomes the first man on Earth. So all of his other stories kind of connect. Like, there are moments in songs where he'll be singing about, like, from one character's point of view, they see someone else and they're doing something. And then an album later, he'll be singing from that person's perspective, seeing the person from the first song doing what they were doing at the exact moment they were singing. And as you're listening, you're like, oh my god, the synapses. The synapses.
That sort of thing.
It's just such a phenomenally interesting way to have forged a music career.
Yeah.
And I recommend getting into, if you're into progressive metal or like Merge, check it out. It's he's really into space metal. 01011001, in case you hadn't guessed, was some like serious space rock. Space metal for sure.
I'm not familiar with the term space metal, and I'm trying to like picture it in my head.
Here's a fun,
I think I can.
Here's a fun fact about Arion. He chose the name because it was like, he based it on Ares, the god.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about epic. And
yeah, literally.
He then decided to take a fantasy sounding name for the start, the Arion part, and then end it with like a sci-fi sounding thing, Rion. As in, like, proton and electron. Yeah.
Them science words.
So that's where Arion comes from.
Huh.
Part fantasy, part metal. Part space. To him, there's nothing more metal than space. It's really charming.
Well, I mean, they say space tastes like metal. So, who knows?
Yeah.
Okay. In a second interesting parallel, I also did music for a third one. I had a long sit down about, like, ooh, do I want to do, like, a mini-series? Because there's, like, a few of those I can think of, or, you know, something like that. But then I got on this whole kind of, like, kick about how we use the term epic to describe a feeling.
Right.
And that led into music, because music is a very emotional art form. It's very evocative and abstract. And so then there was the process of like, okay, well, how do I want to whittle this down? Because, like, there's so many things. Like, I could do, again, like a crazy-ass concept album like that. I thought about, like, Tommy or The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, or, you know, something classic in that vein. I could do, like, a new concept album, like, God, I don't even know. There's a lot. The first one that pops into my head is The Mother, The Mechanic, and The Path by the Early November. I'm not sure why, but it's like a 3-CD... exploration of, I'm not even sure what, because it's been a while and I didn't do it, so I didn't go back and check it out, but now I kind of want to, now that I'm talking. But eventually I kind of whittled it down, and I was like, I'm not even going to do an album, I'm just going to focus on a song. And then I thought, okay, well, like, there's this whole list of songs I could do, and the one that I finally settled is the title track from Television's Marquee Moon. Which is an album that was released in 1977 on Elektra Records. It was recorded in the fall of 76 in New York City. Television, in case you're one of them kids and not familiar, was part of like the kind of CBGB scene in New York, along with like Talking Heads and Patti Smith and like that whole crew. The band, at the time they recorded the record, consisted of Tom Verlaine on vocals and guitar, Richard Lloyd on guitar, Fred Smith on bass, and Billy Fika on drums. They also included, like, Richard Hell was a member for a while.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like there's at least one more. But anyway, Marquee Moon as an album
became kind of really influential and is like generally sort of considered the band's definitive statement. Like, they had a couple other pretty good albums, but like this is the one that people think of. The title track is the fourth song on it. It's the last song on side one. It varies in length, depending on the issue of the record. There's a version that's just a teensy bit shy of 10 minutes, and then there's a version that's almost 11 minutes. It's kind of hard to talk about music without just kind of being like, here it is.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got this kind of, like, angular, knotty, pulsing rhythm to it, where, like, one guitar is just kind of, like, hitting a double hit. A guitar kind of comes in and does this weird little filigree over it, and it starts, like, interlocking and chugging forward, and then, like, the verses kind of come over this churn, and then the second half of the song starts to, like, build and open up and expand, and the tension increases, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and then finally just hits this point where, like, the two guitars are, like, weaving around each other in this kind of, like, jazzy, chorus-y thing that's happening that just suddenly, like, explodes. And they slowly sort of float back down in this quiet passage until they catch themselves back up again and go through one last verse before it finally peters out. And it's this fucking crescendo, which is especially fascinating because apparently, again, according to Wikipedia, so, you know, take that for what it's worth, but apparently the cut on the record, because the song was a couple years old, they had recorded a couple demos of it, including one with Brian Eno, but like they didn't like the way he recorded them, they thought he was a little too clinical. So it was a song that they knew well, and the album cut was recorded in a single take in the studio live.
Wow.
So what's epic about that to me, I think, is that progression that I described, that kind of build and tensing and, you know, crescendo accompanied by a release, is done in a really effective way and evokes the same response as those Mighty Hero narratives. Like, it's the same shape, it's the same feeling, it hits kind of some of the same points. Literally what I have written down here is, like, it just fucking feels it, man. But, like, if sort of the experiential aspect of an epic is that sense of, like, building stakes and building investment. Like, this is a song that, for me at least, and I mean, musical taste is very subjective, so, you know, disclaimer, fine print, all that. But, like, for me at least, like, it gets pumping. Like, you get caught up in it, you get swept away in it and taken to this, like, huge, lofty place, and before you get dropped back in yourself. And, like, that sort of strikes at the core of what epicness is, I think. As a quick side note, and, like, addendum to that, there is an amazing 17-minute version of it on a live bootleg that was recorded right here in Portland, Oregon, live in Portland, 1978. At the Earth Club, which doesn't exist anymore, but I think it used to be over on, like, Trendy First, that area somewhere. So yeah, check that out. It's on YouTube. It's a good one.
Damn. 17 minutes.
Yeah. Like, it's neat. It very clearly, like, follows the same structure, but it's looser and goes off on some more tangents and more meandering. Like, I don't know. It's I listened to both of them as I was writing up the whole note sheet, and like the comparison is fascinating because like one of them feels very tight despite how much it moves, and one of them has that same kind of build but is more free-flowing. I don't know.
I gotta say, like, this is, like, I think the second time in this episode. The listeners are missing out. Alex is miming out, like, every portion of the way that the song itself works. And, yeah. I'm just, you know, it's interspersed. It's great.
Like, that Egyptian hieroglyph with the guy and his arms and, like, the S shape. Like, I'm kind of doing that in motion. A little bit of, like, what is it? Like, inflatable wacky arm flip man.
Yeah. Isn't it funny that there's, like, the feeling of a need for the specific correct term for that thing?
I know. Specificity.
Like, we all know the series of words will explain exactly what it means, but, you know.
Well, it's like that thing I was reading, I don't know, it was an article that, like, made the rounds on social media recently, where it's like, there are exceptions, but for the most part, like, adjectives have a specific order in English.
Yeah.
Depending on what they describe. I don't remember what it is now, but...
Oh, there's like 10 different components.
Yeah, it's a long one.
Very complicated. This is the epic episode. We talk more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, we're getting more comfortable doing this. So
yeah.
It's getting there. There's loosening happening.
So I mentioned the honorable mention.
Oh, yeah.
How mentions work. You mention them.
Which is only fair, because I shoehorned a few into that last one.
I'm not gonna get all the way. I'm not gonna go through all my notes. I want to share with you guys my very favorite band, Radical Face. Radical Face, in terms of epicness, did this 3-album concept album compilation thing. It's one project. They're all called the Family Tree. The first one was the Family Tree, the Roots. Then there was the Branches, and then the Leaves, finally. Each of those albums is a generation or two within this family, which I drew out the family tree.
I didn't realize it was that big.
There's 47 songs between the 3 albums and 4 EPs, which total to 1 album. And I counted 4 generations when I made my family tree version of it, which looks like this.
Oh, wow. Yeah, there's like 30 characters on that, at least.
It took a while to make.
Yeah, like, when you said it was about a family, I just kind of, like, I was picturing more, like, from a single person's perspective about what was around them.
Well, I mean, it starts with two, like, a brother and a sister, and then it's, like, the brother has 5 sons, the sister has 3 kids. Each, I mean, most of them have 2 or 3 kids each. So by the time you get to the bottom, it's there's a lot of
sprawling.
People involved.
Yeah.
Some of the people involved are, like, neighbors, or, like, people who are prominent in their lives for some other reason, or marriages. So they bring a lot in. It's very Faulknerian, which I just really enjoy. Like, the whole project, not only is the language and, like, it's all kind of set in, like, this northern Florida, like, very southern setting. Mm-hmm. It's country, but it's, like, also, like, kind of swampy, and, like, I take it to be where he grew up, in Gainesville, Florida, roughly.
Okay.
And it's Faulknerian in humor. One of my favorite lines in all of his work is a character is describing his life story, and it's right after he says that his mother, you know, had died in this bed while she was giving birth to him. 6 years later, father died in the very same bedroom. Many said it was the grief that did it. I'd have to say it's because he hung himself. It's very clever. All of I mean, it's my favorite musician. I think his lyrics are insanely beautiful. So there's some interesting shit that he does, though. Like, first album in the series has a track called Ghost Towns. It's about this guy, Judah. He's on the run from all kinds of different people because he's made some choices in another song, the story told by that one. All of the songs are short stories, really.
Yeah.
That's what helps, like, move this epic, is there's always something happening to somebody and it's related to something else that somebody else already had happened to them. Judah's on the run in Ghost Towns. Then Reminders is a song on the next album, and it has the same guitar riff at the beginning that just, like, slightly changes as he continues to play on the second song. Mm-hmm. And in both of them, he does the same, like, weird vocal pattern. It's not weird, but it's recognizable. It's like an ooh. And so, like, it comes back in a really interesting way in the second song, and you recognize it. Mm-hmm. And so I checked the map that he created of all of the stories, and it turns out that it's Judah's son is the main character of this story.
Uh-huh.
So then, in the third album, there's a song called Road to Nowhere, and it's about Abel's son, Patrick.
I just want to take a quick aside to, like, highlight the fact that there is a map for this.
Yes, there is a map. It's a beautiful... Go to radicalface.com and then click on the family tree. It'll take you to this map. It has every music video and links to every song, all 47 of them, on the map.
Mm. Not to, like, completely interrupt and derail, but just, like, on the topic of interesting concept albums with, like... Not necessarily maps, though. In one case, there is one, like, you know, who does a lot of interesting, I keep using the word interesting, a lot of, like, fun ones of those is Tori Amos.
Does she?
Mm-hmm. Like, when you said map, I thought of, Scarlet's Walk, which is, a project where, like, each song represents a stage on this, like, winding journey that eventually runs through all 50 states.
Wow.
And, like, the fancy edition of it when it came out came with this, like, big fold-out map that, like, had that path tracked around through it, and, like, different sections of it were, like, different colors, and it was, like, this color is this song, this color is this song. The Strange Little Girls was her cover album, where, like, each song on it was a cover of a song by a man written about it, but from the perspective of a woman, like, covered from the perspective of a woman.
Oh, okay.
And so, like, she created these characters that were each song. Kind of did something similar on American Doll Posse from 2007, where, like, she played, I think, 5 distinct personas that were, like, conversing and interacting with one another. She does a lot of cool stuff like that. So, if you're into that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just wrote it down. I don't want to go on about Radical Face because I want to talk about them again later when they also fit another question. But there's something just truly impressive to me about the amount of time and, like, the scale of it is somehow impressive. Even though it's one family, it's 50 different intense slices of life.
That sounds really interesting.
From a family. You can see the way that he put the work in to make sure that, like, family members are similar to one another in disposition. And some of the songs, I say there are 47 songs, some of the songs are about, like, entire families that you never see for another song. So there's easily
supporting,
like,
supporting characters.
Yeah, I mean, there's like a good 60 characters involved in the making of, like, the stories of the album.
Hmm. Yeah, I have it all on my computer. I'm kind of like, it's one of those things where it's like, oh, if I'm gonna do it, I want to, like, really sit down and do it, and I just haven't allotted myself the time yet. But
it's. I mean, obviously, I think it's worth it. I just. You'll get there, and then you'll experience it, and you'll know, like, this guy Ben Cooper, he's doing something different.
Ah,
So I guess that leads us to a recommendation, like end of, like, oh, yeah, the weekly recommendation.
Fun things this week.
Okay.
So I watched 3 movies in the last week, all 3 of which I really enjoyed, and I kind of had a hard time picking which one I was going to recommend.
Do all 3 of them.
Yeah, so I'm just going to mention 2 and then describe 1. I saw Quiz Show, which was great.
Oh my god, I love that movie.
Saw
the second best movie of 1994.
Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, a great movie.
Also a great movie.
I saw Frost Nixon, I was disappointed.
It's okay.
As soon as Ron Howard's name came up on the screen, I was like, oh, I'm going to like this movie less than I thought. No offense to him, I guess. I just, like, he's not my movie.
Yeah. There's a lot about it that I like. Like, I don't know if it completely gets where it's trying to go, but I don't know. It's very slick.
The one that I really wanted to recommend is called On a Hard Body. This is a 1994 documentary. It was filmed in Texas. The idea of the movie is to watch people who participate in a contest. And the contest goes like this. Your name gets drawn. If you want to, you can put your hand on a brand new truck. And the last one to take their truck, their hand off the truck, wins the truck. Or, as everyone says in this documentary in the heart of Texas, truck. So, it starts with 23 people.
You love a southern accent.
It starts with 23 people and very quickly dwindles to... And actually, you know, everybody makes it a full day. I will tell you, no spoiler necessarily, it does make it to 3 days.
Yeah.
So you get the psychological portrait of all of the people who would be willing to do this and do it and then failed to do it. It's fascinating. I mean...
That does sound cool.
It's a little bit bizarre the way that the film is made. Some choices are just like... Like, they'll have somebody talk for a while with someone else's name on the screen.
Hmm.
Even though it's a picture of the person who's talking and they're not that person. Like, the little stuff, like, towards the beginning like that. But towards the end, it's just footage of the people... like the second two-thirds of the movie are just like, this is what's happening to these people, and mostly they're losing their fucking mind.
I bet. That does sound cool.
Yeah, so check out Hands, like, on a Hard Body.
I've heard of that sort of competition, but like the idea of actually, like, it seems like a great subject for a documentary.
It's really entertaining.
I kind of forgot about this part, actually. But, let's see. I know I talked about Car Seat Headrest last week, but, like, listening to that album made me want to, like, go back and listen to his other ones, and then, like, I ended up listening to one song in particular, like, 500 times. So I do want to mention it. It's Cosmic Hero, track 9 off Teens of Denial. From 2016. It's an 8.5-minute song about addiction and depression and stuff. So, like, I mean, the first line of it is something to the effect of, like, if you really wanted it to last, you would commit yourself completely.
Well, what did you say the name of the artist was?
Car Seat Headrest.
Ah.
So there's that. I went to see Red Sparrow yesterday, which was interesting, and I liked more than I expected to. Because I went in, like, knowing nothing about it other than Jennifer Lawrence is a Russian spy and it's 2.5 hours long. But it's an interesting spy movie, because, like... It's very much about, like, sex and violence. It's a very slow burn kind of thing. It's not an action movie, really, at all. Which is... When you see that in a spy movie, it's usually about, like, older spies late in the game. And this is, like, about becoming a spy, but, like, done kind of with that sort of approach. Also, really...
fun cast, including but not limited to Jeremy Irons, Charlotte Rampling, and a surprise Mary Louise Parker. So there's that. That was pretty good too. Other than that, I have not really done much this week. I watched a lot of Law and Order.
TV does that. I stopped watching TV before I go to bed. I just watch a movie instead. Mm-hmm. I'm watching so many movies now.
I know. Like, I'm trying to, like, get back into that phase. There's, like, a couple more TV shows that I want to check out. But, like, I have a long list of movies, so...
I just... I'll sit there and I'll watch TV for, like, 6 hours while I'm trying to sleep.
And it's just, like, that... It's hard to absorb in chunks that big, but it's also hard to not do chunks that big when it's available.
Yeah. So. And the point of TV is to be serialized, so.
Yeah. I mean, that's a whole show right there. Like, what's television doing right now? Because it's changing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just super long filmmaking.
Yeah.
I say just as though that's a bad thing, or, like, it reduces it somehow. That vastly complicates it.
Yeah.
But, like, you know.
One of the... I wish to God I could remember where I read this quote, but I can't, so I can't attribute it right now, but know that I didn't think of it. Somebody said something to the effect of, like, you know, what if the novel were 40 years old as an art form?
Yeah.
I guess, like, probably closer to 60, but still.
Yeah, we have some time left on the clock to figure TV out.
Yeah.
And think about video games.
Oh my god. No, like, when I went up to Cyan a couple summers ago, like, one of the guys, like, the guy who was, like, giving us the little tour of the office, who was, like, a friend of a friend, talked about how they, like, for the game that they were working on, were, like, working on a VR version of it, and, like, how they do, like, some of the filmmaking for that, because there's actual, like, live action in it. And, like, we ended up having this interesting conversation about, like, what will happen when movies are immersive in that way.
Yeah.
Like, what would directing that be like? Because you're never going to see the same movie twice, because you're going to be looking at something different every time. Or are you? How do you direct attention outside the confines of the screen? Like, ugh. I'm getting all fired up now.
Yeah, there's so much you could do with it. Honestly, it appeals to me to be watching a movie and then just, like, wander off. Decide, like, maybe you go to see a movie and it's, like, not the movie that you thought you were going to be seeing.
Yeah.
And so you're just like, well, let's see what's on the perimeter here. Like, or when you really love a movie, like, you've seen it 8 times. Like, you got new stuff to explore. Oh, that's fascinating.
And, like, imagine a movie where, like, the first couple of times you see it, you're watching this big, like, elaborate, crazy fight scene that's happening in front of you, but then, like, maybe the third time or whatever, you're, like, you look around behind you and there's, like, something happening among the people who are reacting to the fight scene that, like, explains something that happens 10 scenes later, and you're like, aha! That adds depth to that, and I never fucking saw it. Like, the potential for that is so huge.
Yeah, that's... Alright, well,
That would be fucking epic.
That would be fucking epic. This is what we do. This is why we come together to talk about it, because ideas like that come up. It's like, oh, shit. I want that. I want that in my life, and I want it tomorrow.
Oh, God.
I'd want it today, but it's already late.
We're getting closer. It is late. I should go to bed. I'm an old person. All right. So, on that note, we'll decide on something for next week, or... you're going out of town next week, aren't you?
Yeah, but...
So, eventually.
Yeah, so let's say that our topic next week is the one that you mentioned earlier.
Oh, came too late.
Yeah, let's. Which parties did we arrive too late?
Okay.
Actually, I can already think of a good example, because my very favorite, my very first favorite song was a song that was, like, already detested by the time I was old enough to, like, track it down.
I look forward to it.
Oh, it's going to be... Yeah, let me write that down before I forget. Thanks for listening, folks.
Yep. And, I guess ask yourself, does it matter? I don't know. I'm trying to think of a good tagline, but and that is not it. But next time, it's a process.
Yeah, I mean, we got to title this episode. That's right? A big step. Be patient.
Should bake a cake.